Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks so much for being here with us. We got open forum today, 2 hours of open forum. Second hour, Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, will be here. And first hour, Jimmy Akin with us. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett, and surprise! I promised that there would be a surprise for people the next time I appeared live on the show, and for the for those who are viewing us on video, whether on YouTube or Catholic.com or wherever they view us, the surprise is already visibly manifest. I'm in a different location than I traditionally have been on the show. People have commented on and seen the room from which I normally, up to now, have done Catholic Answers Live, but I'm somewhere else. And in fact, I'm more than 1,500 miles away from where I've previously done the show.
That's practically in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah. Previously, I was 3 miles from the office of Catholic Answers. Now I'm 1,500 miles, not in the direction of the Pacific Ocean, but in the other direction. I'm 1,500 miles east of San Diego, and so I moved back to my hometown of Fayetteville, Arkansas. I bought a house here, and it's really great, and I'm much closer to family. And so I've been in California for 30 years. I still work for Catholic Answers. We have remote apologists, you know, Trent Horn and Joe Heschmeyer and Carlo Bursard, and now me, are all actually in this part of the country. We're all in, or either are or are about to be in Texas and Oklahoma and Arkansas and Kansas. And so given the marvels of technology, it's possible for me to work from a home office 3 miles from home base or 1,500 miles from home base. And after 30 years in California, it was time for me to go home and be with family. So I'm here. I'm very happy. Currently, the room I'm in is not really decorated yet, but it will be in the fullness of time.
Well, congratulations on the move, Jimmy.
Thank you. And of course, you already knew about it because I told you personally, but and people at Catholic Answers knew this was coming, but and I announced it on Facebook, but once I got here, but this will be new for some folks.
And the everything got delivered properly and the travels were uneventful?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
The travels were uneventful, but my stuff is still in transit. So,
okay.
And then I'm going to have a bunch of organizing to do, but I've got help to do it, and I should have things back to normal pretty quickly.
Boy, I got to say, this connection is really good, though. It sounds like you're sitting next to me in the studio. It doesn't sound, there's no delay, nothing.
I have much better internet here in the Ozark Mountains than I did in San Diego, believe it or not.
Yeah, I believe it because I know the company that provides it here in San Diego. Well, Jimmy, that is just great. Did you miss any episodes of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, or did you just keep plugging away?
We actually record a few months in advance on Mysterious World. And so there's no interruption in our regular Friday episodes. Last week, of course, we introduced people to a Lakota Sioux medicine man named Black Elk, who had lots of paranormal experiences, a very eventful life. He was at many major battles. And in the 20th century, he was interviewed for a couple of books. But the people who did the books were very careful to hide something that was extremely important to Black Elk. They really wanted to play down one aspect of his life, and that was the fact that we actually tell you about it in tomorrow's episode, but it was the fact that he became a Catholic, and today he is a servant of God, and his cause for canonization as a Catholic saint is up in Rome. So we're going to be telling you all about Nicholas Black Elk's Catholic life, his beliefs, and how he integrated that with his Lakota heritage.
How cool, Jimmy. Oh, what a great twist. That's wonderful. So that'll drop tomorrow on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Oh, very, very cool. Very cool. The number here is 888-318-7884. I haven't even looked at the phones yet, so I'll tell you right now. Let's see how many lines are open. One, carry the two. Zero. So we know that happens when Jimmy's here. They line up quickly, so off we go to the phones. Let's start with Ryan, our old friend Ryan in Midland, Texas, listening on the new and improved Catholic Answers app. Ryan, thanks for downloading the app, and thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. No, no.
First.
Ryan, I think I cut you off there. Go ahead again. Start again.
Okay. I actually have a two-part question if you have time after the first one. It's short.
Well, let's
What's your first question?
Okay. I was wondering, Jimmy, after the apostles scattered, since they weren't in communication, how did the successors of the other apostles, other than Peter, know that they are supposed to pledge their allegiance to the Bishop of Rome?
Well, today in the papacy, we have a formal ceremony where the cardinals, after a new pope is elected, they will perform a ritual where they declare their submission to the Roman pontiff. But other bishops besides the cardinals don't. They assume they're in communion with the Bishop of Rome. They don't have any formal ceremony they go through to declare that. So it's not something that you have to declare. It's not something you have to pledge. Just like ordinary Catholics, you know, you or me or Cy Kellett. Well, I don't know how ordinary he is, but, you know, us ordinary Catholics, we don't have to ritually pledge allegiance to a new pope when a new pope is elected. We just have to not break communion with the pope. And in the same way, the various bishops in different parts of the world that succeeded the apostles didn't have to do anything special when St. Peter's successors were elected. It was just assumed they would remain in communion unless they did something specifically to break communion. And fortunately, that didn't tend to happen very often. And so there was a large, stable Christian community that was in communion with the Roman pontiff, and the Catholic Church continued to grow.
And Ryan, you said you'd be quick, so let's have that second question.
Okay. Since you briefly mentioned breaking communion, can you kind of summarize how exactly did the Orthodox maintain valid succession, apostolic succession, and holy orders and everything else, whereas that wasn't the case with the Anglicans? Because I've never been able to figure that out.
So being in communion with Rome has nothing to do with whether or not your sacraments are valid. So if you break communion, you will, in principle, continue to have a full, if you had apostolic succession, meaning you had valid holy orders and so forth, then you will in principle have a valid set of seven sacraments, unless you do something to invalidate the passing on of holy orders. And the traditional Catholic understanding is that's what happened in the Anglican Communion. They would have still continued to have valid holy orders, and they did for a while in their first generation. The first generation of Anglican bishops were validly ordained. And if they had not altered the rite and the intention that they used to ordain new bishops, then they would have continued to validly ordain bishops who would have validly ordained priests who would be able to perform all the sacraments and so forth. But unfortunately, unlike the Eastern Orthodox, after they broke communion, they altered the rite of ordination and they altered the intention of what they were, of what ordination meant. And so in the judgment of Pope Leo XIII, who issued the most famous document on this, it was the one that settled the question, not infallibly, but in the opinion of some infallibly, but not necessarily infallibly, because he doesn't use the right mode of language for that, in my opinion. But he did issue a very strong ruling that, based on historical evidence regarding alterations in the rite of ordination and the intention that was expressed in the rite of ordination in the Anglican Communion, they unfortunately lost valid holy orders very quickly after they broke from Rome.
Ryan, thanks very much for getting us started today. We got to take a quick break. Jimmy Akin, our guest, it's Open Forum. Right back with more after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Discover the beauty, truth, and goodness of the Church. With the EWTN Online Learning Series, you can delve into the riches of the faith and grow closer to the Lord with free videos and study guides. Enroll in the EWTN Online Learning Series free courses today at learningseries.ewtn.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Still having the flash sale for the pilgrimage till tomorrow. That's CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com, CatholicAnswersPilgrimage.com. But I also want to invite you to the big conference coming up. We got that. The conference is I Believe in God. It's all about God and also about how to talk to people about God in the modern world, how we can make arguments that will be helpful to people and explanations that will be helpful to people and the attributes of God. We're just talking about God at the Catholic Answers Conference this year. It's the last full weekend of September. You can find out all about it over at CatholicAnswersConference.com, CatholicAnswersConference.com. They've still got the early bird special going on over at CatholicAnswersConference.com. $50 savings when you sign up. Use the promo code EARLY, CatholicAnswersConference.com. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. The phone line's full, and off we go to Stevens Point, Wisconsin, where Mitchell is listening on the Catholic Answers app. Mitchell, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. So my question was something that a good Catholic friend asked me this past Sunday, and I wasn't 100% sure how to answer. She was telling me about how sometimes she listens to music that is like a musical retelling of the Greek or Norse epics. And, you know, it seems like obviously those would, for the most part, probably portray those gods in a positive light. And so I was kind of wondering, is that... just listening to the kind of that stuff for entertainment, is that good?
Well, it's going to depend on the individual and, you know, how strong they are in their faith and whether their faith is threatened by this. But it is not in principle wrong, you know, and there are various ways of showing that. One of them, if you read St. Paul's writings, and if you read the book of Acts, where St. Paul in Acts 17 is talking to the Areopagus in Athens, he repeatedly quotes from Greek sources, including Greek religious sources. He uses them, actually, quotations from them, to support the gospel, the Christian gospel. He points out that even though he doesn't approve of their worship of other deities, he notes that he found an altar in Athens dedicated to an unknown god. And the Greeks in Athens had correctly realized there must be a god that we're not worshiping, and we want to pay him his proper respects. So even though we don't know who he is, we're going to worship him anyway. And St. Paul says, well, that's who I'm here to tell you about. I'm here to tell you about the God you don't know, the one true God who's the creator. And he, in the process of discussing this with him, he quotes from Greek poets who were in their original context talking about Zeus, and says, even your own poets have said, we are all his children. And so the Greeks, even though they had misunderstandings about God and, you know, thought Zeus was the major god, they had a genuine insight that there is a sense in which mankind is God's children. And so what Paul was trying to do was not get them to utterly reject everything from their heritage, but to correct their misunderstandings but retain the genuine spiritual insights they had. And what that means for our purposes is Paul knew Greek literature. So he knew he wouldn't be able to quote from Greek sources if he hadn't read them. And so he obviously had been familiar with Greek stories about the gods, with Greek literature about their gods, and he used that literature in the service of the gospel. So what this shows us is that it is not in principle wrong to expose oneself, if you're strong in your faith, like St. Paul is, if you're not tempted to worship Greek gods, there's nothing wrong with learning the literature of another people who have a different religion. And the same thing would be true of learning about Norse mythology or learning about Hindu mythology or Shinto mythology. In fact, missionaries, wherever they have functioned in the world, have needed to learn about the local religion and then sort through it and see what in this is good, what can I build on to help bring people to Jesus, but also what needs to be rejected. And that means learning their literature, learning their stories. Now, you asked about your friend doing this for entertainment rather than evangelistic purposes. But as long as her faith is not being undermined by this, as long as she continues to be a good Christian, there's nothing wrong with entertainment value. You know, Christians down through the ages have, for example, read the Iliad and the Odyssey for fun. Not as just an educational exercise, but because the Greek poet Homer told great stories. And yeah, the Greek gods do appear in those stories and they do stuff. But if you don't believe in them, if you don't believe in the Greek gods, you can still enjoy the Iliad and the Odyssey as works of fiction, which actually have a loose connection to history. But you don't have to be threatened by reading a story about a god you don't believe in, just like you can read Marvel comics about Thor and not end up as a Thor worshiper. You can just enjoy the story.
Okay, Mitchell?
Yes, thanks a lot.
Okay.
That's helpful.
All right. You're very welcome.
No problem.
Thank you. We're going now to Matt in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, listening on 97.3 FM. Matt, thank you for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, thank you. And first of all, I'd like to say thank you guys very much for a great program. I enjoy it a lot.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt.
No problem. My question was about becoming Catholic. Last year, I started going to a Catholic church, and I saw a bunch of the people there get up, and it turns out they were going through RCIA. And this was one of their things that they had to do. And I looked at the website, and I found out about RCIA, and I contacted them and got into it. I got into the class too late, so I couldn't become Catholic last year, but they allowed me to go to all the classes. It was wonderful. So I was really looking forward to it this year. And at our parish, it starts next month. Classes are every Wednesday. In the meantime, I have been laid off, so I'm looking for another job, and it's likely my new job involves a lot of travel, and I'm really worried that I won't be able to be Catholic this year because I don't know how many of those classes I'll be able to make, and I just wanted your guys' thoughts. Am I right thinking if I'm not in town and I can't make the classes, then you can't become Catholic?
Matt, I need my answer is going to be fundamentally the same, but first I need a piece of information from you. Have you already been baptized in another Christian church, or are you unbaptized?
Unbaptized.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a little easier if you've already been baptized elsewhere, but if you're unbaptized, you do need a comprehensive background in the Christian faith before coming into the church. But that doesn't mean that you have to acquire that on any particular schedule. So what I would do in your situation is I would talk to the pastor at the parish or the director of the RCIA program or both. and say, here's my situation. I really want to become Catholic. I've been attending for over a year. I've taken a bunch of RCIA already, but I'm going to have to be taking a new job, and I'm not sure how many of this year's classes I'll be able to attend. What else could we do to make sure I get the background I need before being baptized? And they may be able, for example, to have someone who is part of one of the RCIA catechists meet with you privately to fill in, classes that you weren't able to attend, and give you private coaching or private instruction, I should say. But there would be a bunch of different possibilities. It's not a requirement that you go through the standard RCIA classes on the particular schedule the parish has set. What is required is that you get the background you need. But there are bunches of different ways of doing that. And I would talk with the pastor and or the RCIA director to say, how can we do that in this situation? Because you're obviously, serious about this. You've been attending this church for, a year or more. You've already been going to RCIA, and so you already have some background, but it's just a matter of filling in those holes. And I would hope and expect that the officials at the parish would be willing to work with you. If they're not, you might consider, now I see you're in Oklahoma City, or in the Oklahoma City area, go to a different parish. There may be other parishes that have RCIA schedules that would fit your schedule better, or if you're going to be out of town for weeks at a time, if the parish you're currently attending isn't able to accommodate your request, another parish in Oklahoma City might be able to accommodate it. So there are bunches of options, and I would be encouraging to you as you explore them, and God bless you, and I look forward to when you're able to enter the church.
Matt, thank you very much. If you want to hang on, I'll be happy to send you Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It. Just hang on, and we'll send that to you if you would like it. I'm going to go to Carolyn in Kilmarnock, Virginia. Carolyn, thanks for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you for taking my call. And first, I just want to say thank you guys so much for what you do. I've been listening for a couple months now, and it has just really blessed me. And I just feel like I know so much more about my faith from the podcast.
Well, that's beautiful, Carolyn.
So my question is a little bit long, so bear with me. But my cousin, who is a cradle Catholic, she has recently started what she calls her spiritual journey, which involves some pretty heavy meditation, and she says she's had visions. And her most recent vision, she pictured Jesus with the nails popping off and him kind of rising from the cross, which is cool. But from that, she has developed a real aversion to the image of the crucifix, to the point where she kind of said, why is it in churches? Why is this the only image that we see in the Catholic Church? And kind of felt like it shouldn't be there.
All right.
So how can we explain why a devotion to the crucifix and the image, just even of just Jesus suffering, is important that we have that kind of front and center?
Okay, well, first of all, I'd say that it is not true that the crucifix is the only image you see in the Catholic Church. You will also see bare crosses where it's just the cross and there's not a corpus or body of Jesus on it. You will see that. You'll even see, in some places, an image of a cross that has the resurrected Christ hanging in front of it, not on it, but in front of it. And it's clearly the resurrected Christ. So you do see other forms of crosses in the Catholic Church. You see a wide range of them, in fact. But when it comes to the crucifix, where you have the body of Christ, there's a very good reason why we have that. And it's because we want to remember what Jesus did for us on the cross. If you read the Gospels, and this is something that's important when one is receiving or apparently receiving private revelations, one should never allow the private revelation to contradict or go against what we know from public revelation, which is found, for example, in the Bible. Because private revelations, we're, as individuals, if God speaks to us, we're not biblical authors. We're not divinely inspired in the same way. And so we may misunderstand things. We may misperceive things. We make mistakes in a way that the biblical authors did not. And so private revelation is less authoritative than biblical revelation. And in the Bible, it doesn't depict Jesus having the nails pop out of his hands and him rise off the cross. We know he hung on the cross until he was dead, and that's something that's emphasized in all four of the Gospels. There's a little more to say about this, but I'll say it on the other side of the break.
Hang on, if you would, Carolyn, we'll take this break. If you'd like to call, it's open forum, 888-318-7884. This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns its attention to the question of God in an age of unbelief. Join us September 21st through 24th in San Diego for I Believe in God, featuring very special guest Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers. Spend four fun days with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
What if the voice of your deepest doubts about Catholicism rose up in the form of a human being and challenged you to defend your most foundational beliefs? That's the task apologist Trent Horn took upon himself in his new book, Devil's Advocate, a dialogue with his own best objections against the faith that he professes and defends. You can stand up against your doubts, and Trent will show you how. Pick up your copy of Devil's Advocate today at shop.catholic.com or at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin is our guest this hour. It's open forum. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Jimmy, on the line is Carolyn in Virginia, and you were just explaining to her why we use the image of the crucifix in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, and in the Gospels, and this is in all four of the Gospels, we have records that depict Christ being crucified. They explicitly talk about what he did on the cross for us. And we need to remember that. In fact, that's the reason that God inspired the Gospels to be written, because the crucifixion is one of the most important. In fact, it's the pivotal event in salvation history. And so consequently, we need to remember it. We need to know what Jesus did. We need to honor Jesus for what he did. And one of the ways that Christians have done that historically is by depicting what Jesus did. And they can depict it in a bunch of different forms. They can depict it verbally by reading the Gospels out loud. They can depict it in art by painting pictures of Jesus on the cross. They can depict it in motion pictures in which Jesus, the ministry of Jesus is shown, and Jesus is depicted being on the cross. In fact, if you watched a movie about the life of Jesus or a TV show about the life of Jesus, and it didn't show him on the cross, you'd think there's something wrong here. Why are they doing this? And we thus shouldn't be averse to seeing Jesus on the cross, because he thought it was important for him to go to the cross for us. And consequently, we shouldn't shy away from that. We need, in fact, to understand just what he went through on our behalf, because it shows us two things that are very important. Number one, it shows us the gravity of our sins. You know, the fact that it took something like this to atone for our sins, that's a lesson we need to understand. And secondly, it shows us just how much God loves us in spite of our sins, that he was willing to do this. And if we say, I'm never going to think about the crucifixion, I'm never going to have an image of the crucifixion, then we're cutting ourselves off from those two most important lessons. And that is something that we should not do. As St. Paul says in his writings to the Corinthians, I would know nothing among you except Christ and him crucified, not and him risen. He did also tell him about that, but, and that's important, you know, he says Christ was crucified for our salvation and raised for our justification. So the resurrection is a very important thing to St. Paul. But just as important is the message of the crucifixion. And so we need to not be afraid of that. We need to respect it. We need to honor what Jesus did for us on the cross. And one way of doing that is by having crucifixes. And so if on the basis of a private revelation, your friend is saying we shouldn't do that, then either the private revelation she is receiving is not an authentic private revelation, or she's just misinterpreting its implications. And either one of those could be the case. She could just be misapplying what she's learned from the private revelation, but she needs to be careful, because at least at present, she appears to be using what she believes she's privately received to undermine the message that the gospel writers and St. Paul convey to us about the crucifixion.
And Carolyn, I am going to leave that there. I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very, very much. We are welcoming into the studio Thomas, the TikTok engine, with a question from TikTok, and Jimmy's answer will go back to TikTok. And Thomas, welcome.
Hi, Si. Thanks for having me again. Jimmy, glad to see you're safe in Arkansas now.
Yeah, very glad to be here.
Yeah, it's like nothing's really changed, though. It's still nice to see you on camera anyway. And to christen that new Arkansas studio, if you could answer this question for us. This person on TikTok wants to know, could you explain why priests need to be in celibacy? In the Bible, it says a good priest should be a man of one wife or something similar. So why?
Well, basically, priests don't have to be celibate. There are Catholic priests who are not celibate, who are married. There are married Catholic priests in several of the Eastern rites of the Catholic Church, and even in the Latin rite of the Catholic Church, there are some married men who are ordained to the priesthood. They typically have been ministers in other denominations who were married and then became Catholic and then were ordained as Catholic priests. So it is possible, this is not a matter of doctrine, it is possible for Catholic priests to be married. And in some places, and in some cases, they are married. But the church has also discerned that it's very good for priests to be unmarried. It's not a requirement by divine law that they be unmarried, but it's a good thing. Some of the reasons for that are practical, because if you're a married man, you have to devote time and attention, and not just a little bit, but serious time and attention to your wife and your children. And that's going to take your focus away from your ministry. This is something that's found in the Protestant community, for example. If you go into a Protestant bookstore, you'll find a shelf frequently of books about how to manage the demands of both ministry and family, because it's not easy to do that. And you'll find books written specifically for Protestant pastors about how to balance those two things. You'll find books for Protestant ministers' wives to talk about the difficulties of being a Protestant minister's wife, and you'll find books for the children of Protestant ministers about, you know, how to deal with the problems of, well, I'm this minister's kid, so there's all this extra pressure on me that's not on other kids, and my dad's distracted by ministry. He may be paying more attention to that than to me. And so it creates real problems when you have a married minister. And so one of the benefits is practical, that it frees up the priest for wholehearted attention to ministry. There's also another reason that's not practical but spiritual, and that's the fact that we will all end up in this state anyway. As Jesus tells us in the resurrection, people are neither going to marry nor be given in marriage. We're all going to be celibate, and we'll all be wholeheartedly devoted to God the way Jesus was. Jesus himself practiced celibacy. And when the disciples asked him about marriage and divorce, one of the things he said is some people are eunuchs, meaning in this case unmarried, for the sake of the kingdom. And he says this is not everybody's gift, but it is some people's gift, and they should accept it. In other words, not engaging in marriage for purposes of serving the kingdom. And the Catholic Church has, for the most part in the West, applied that principle to the priesthood. So, and St. Paul also, similarly, he practiced celibacy, and he recommended it to others. He recommends it to Timothy, telling him that no good soldier gets entangled in civilian affairs, and he's counseling St. Timothy to remain single so he can devote himself to ministry as a soldier of Christ. So we see celibacy being practiced in the New Testament itself by both Christ and his ministers, at least some of them, and that indicates this is a good thing, and the church has seen fit to have that be its normal discipline for most of the priests in the Latin rite of the church. It could change that one day, but if it did so, it would be giving up some of the goods that are associated with celibacy, like being able to be devoted to Christ and to ministry, and also being conformed to the state that we're all going to end up in anyway.
Great, thanks, Jimmy. It's almost like another instance of the great Catholic both and, right? Like celibacy and marriage are both good, and even in the priestly life.
I'm glad Indeed. That you said that, because very soon there will be a Mrs. TikTok engine.
Yeah, that's not going to be her legal last name, but yes.
Oh, well, and then there will be baby TikTok engine.
So. When you put it like that, that's even scarier.
A whole little yard of TikTok engines.
Yeah, you're going to see a lot of me in the studio next week too, because I got to build up a bunch of questions to post while I'm off with the future Mrs. TikTok engine.
But congratulations to both of you.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thomas.
Thank you, man.
That brings us right up to the break. Let's take a break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
In Morse code, the sequence SOS is a distress call. It's been said that it stands for Save Our Souls. Well, right now our world is in big trouble, and we're putting out an SOS call for help. Will you answer that call? St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, has hundreds of teams who share the good news with souls who don't know Jesus. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to get involved.
Divine Intimacy Radio.
The greatest joy in my life is helping others to come to know Christ more fully. And there's no better light on this path, the path to deep union with God, than the wisdom of the saints. Talking about this daily on EWTN Radio is one of the great joys of my life.
Divine Intimacy Radio, Sunday, 6:30 a.m., 1:30 p.m., and 11 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum, Jimmy Akin, our guest. Look at Mrs. TikTok Engine and Mr. TikTok Engine embracing there in the studio. How nice. Getting ready for their upcoming nuptials. Open Forum means open to anybody and any question at all when Jimmy's here. And let's see what we got next. We are going to Peter in Wisconsin, watching on YouTube. Peter, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, so... tomorrow's Friday, and I was going to buy lunch for my coworkers, and I was they're going to want like a burger, which it's Friday. So I was wondering if it was like it feels wrong to go and buy them meat on Friday, but that's okay, right?
Yeah, it's totally okay. This is not Lent, and I don't know if your friends are Catholic or not, but there is no requirement for people who are not Catholic. There is no requirement that they abstain from meat on any day of the year, because that requirement is a creation of Catholic Church law. It applies only to Catholics. And it in this country, it applies only to Catholics on Ash Wednesday and the Fridays of Lent, including Good Friday. So we're not in Lent, and everybody is free to eat meat on Friday if they want. And so there's no issue here. If they want burgers, order them burgers or pay for their burgers. If they want vegetarian, order that. If they want fish, order that. Leave it up to them.
Okay, but so one of them was sort of Catholic, not really anymore. But is it like, I mean, I don't eat meat on any Friday.
Well, that's your choice. That's your choice. I make the same choice. I don't eat meat on Fridays either, but that's a personal choice. It is not something I'm required to do. And so, at least outside of Lent. And so don't get scrupulous about this. Don't look askance at the choices other people make, because even among Catholics, they are not required to abstain from meat on Fridays in this country. So don't take away their liberty. Don't look down on them for exercising their liberty. Don't worry about it.
Peter, thanks very, very much. Hope that was helpful to you. Michael's in Quinlan, Texas, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Michael, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Well, I can't ask my question because I was told that I can't ask it. But you just said that I could ask any question I want to during open forum. But according to the gal that took my call, she said,
Michael, we're not going to debate this issue on the air. If you have a question for me, ask it right now or we'll need to move on.
I do have a question, and that is if you could do me a favor and spell the name of the book that has all the partial and full indulgences in it, because I don't know how they pronounced it earlier today, and I don't know how to spell it.
I'll tell you the name of the book. Its title gets translated into English two different ways. One way is the Handbook of Indulgences. And so if you look up Handbook of Indulgences, you will find it. There's also another way that its name gets brought into English, and it's called the Enchiridion of Indulgences. Enchiridion is a Greek word that means handbook. And how you spell Enchiridion is Enchiridion. So once again, since this is your question, I assume you got something to write with, or you can go back and watch the video. Once again, that's Enchiridion. Enchiridion of Indulgences.
Michael, thanks very, very much. On we go to Denver, Colorado, where Bryce is watching on YouTube. Bryce, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy. My question was how it seems like in Catholic theology, the only way a Catholic can lose their salvation is by committing a mortal sin. But it seems like any time that would happen, it would always be in kind of a very particular event, like, oh, this is the last time I have available for Mass today. I'm going to skip it anyway, even though I know that's really wrong. Or, you know, I want to steal something from the store. I take it, right? It seems like it's always a particular event. But then we also have these parables in the Gospels, like the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16, the sheep and the goats in Matthew 25, where it seems like a lifelong neglect of the poor is something that can exclude someone from salvation. But it doesn't seem to me how someone could, like, in a particular event say, oh, I know I should really be donating, but I'm going to not do that in a grave way. So I was wondering how you would make sense of that.
So one can, in addition to particular single, there's still a concrete act. It's just not as visible a one as, say, committing an act of grand theft. But one can say at some point to oneself, you know, I'm just going to spend all my money on myself. I'm not really going to worry about the, I'm not really going to worry about the poor. And if you make that as a permanent lifelong decision, you're never going to help anybody, even though they have grave needs and you have the means to help them. Then you are doing something that is a single concrete act, which is grave matter, and you're doing it knowingly and deliberately, and it would thus constitute a mortal sin. So if you make a decision to just never help the poor, even though you encounter a poor person who has grave needs and you have the ability to help without, you know, gravely harming yourself, then that is a decision you're making as a concrete act that would result in you committing a mortal sin. So it is possible to do that. It's just the act is an internal one rather than an exterior one, which is, you know, visible objectively, like, you know, stealing something or committing adultery or committing murder. Now, having said that, that does, I don't want people to be scrupulous about this, because people at various points in their lives may not be in a position to help the poor. They may be poor themselves. I remember when I was first married, my wife and I at one point were going through the cushions of our couch trying to find enough coins to buy a can of lemonade and a pack of hot dogs so we could eat that night. You know, well, I wasn't in much of a position to be helping the poor then, because I was one of them. And I needed to spend the money that I had on me and my wife. Similarly, someone may, you know, have plans to help the poor in the future, or they may help them on some occasions. It's not like you've got to respond to every single poor person that you encounter. Especially in this country, we have social safety nets that are designed to help people. We have collective efforts to help the poor through taxation that run social programs and so forth. And so it's not like you have to respond to every single request. If you did, you would bankrupt yourself. And the same, that would have been true in the ancient world too. So there is a role for exercising discretion and saying what's reasonable given what I'm doing, you know, given my circumstances and my resources and my time and energy, what is it reasonable for me to do for the poor? But so we don't want to be scrupulous about this, but it would be possible for someone to say, yeah, I know I'm wealthy and I could easily write a check to a charity that would feed poor people, but I'm just not going to do that. And it would be possible for someone to, as a single concrete act, commit a mortal sin in this area, but it's not as common as you would think, because most people don't think that way. They do have a generous heart. They plan to help others in the future or in the present when it's reasonable for them to do so, but not on every single occasion.
That makes sense, Bryce? Oh, hang on, Bryce. Does that make sense, Bryce?
Yep, that was very helpful. Thank you, Jimmy.
Very good. Thank you very, very much. Appreciate the question.
Cy Kellett, let's do line five.
All right, let me go to line five. We will go to Lynn, listening on Louisiana Catholic Community Radio. Lynn, thank you very, very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Okay, thank you. I had a question or a comment about the man that called in about eating meat on Friday, and the response was that, okay, that's been lifted completely except for during Lent. But
in this country.
Hello?
Go ahead, yep. Go ahead.
I've talked to several priests in the confessional and outside of confession, and I've been told that, yeah, you can eat meat on Friday, but the church teaching is you have to do something in return, do another penance.
Okay, well, number one.
I was just wondering.
Yeah. So number one, this is not a matter of church teaching. It's a matter of church teaching that the faithful do some form of penance at some places in their lives, but the particulars of that are not matters of teaching, they are matters of law. And so what's the law in the church? Well, the universal law that applies everywhere in the Latin Rite, unless the local bishop's conference has made other provisions, is to abstain from meat on Ash Wednesday and on Fridays. But here in the United States, in the 1960s, the U.S. bishops modified that for the territory of the United States. And what they did was they restricted the obligation to not eat meat to just Ash Wednesday and the Fridays of Lent, including Good Friday. And they did not impose a requirement to do something else on other Fridays. They encouraged people to do something else on other Fridays, but they did not make it a requirement. And I've done a careful study of the documents that are relevant to this. You can find them at my website, jimmyakin.com. That's J-I-M-M-Y-A-K-I-N as in Nancy, jimmyakin.com. And if you search on, actually, probably the best place to go is under popular posts and then annual Lent fight, because Lent can be very contentious for some people. So look under popular posts and then annual Lent fight. You'll find stuff about the Fridays of Lent and other Fridays of the year where I go through the legal documents in great detail. Now, many priests, there is this popular meme out there in Catholic culture that if you're not going to abstain from meat on Friday, you need to do something else as a penance. And a lot of priests have just heard that meme and they haven't actually carefully studied the law. But I have done a careful study of the law on this point, and I can assure you, when you read what the bishops actually said and you don't read into it other things, they terminate the obligation to abstain from meat on Fridays outside of Lent, and they do not impose another requirement in its place. They encourage the voluntary doing of something else, but they do not make it a requirement.
Does that make sense to you?
Much.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to go to Angel in Ohio, listening on the app. Angel, if you can be quick with your question, we can do our very best to get an answer from Jimmy for you.
Oh, thank you so much.
We do need
what
you to
your
go
question,
quick,
Angel.
Well, my question is, I was in France for many years. I don't know. I'm engaged to a French man who lived behind the
Angel, if you're, I don't have time for the background to the question. I need just the question so I can answer it.
I'm wondering, when we would go to the Papal Palace, the French people would say they didn't want any popes to come ever to Avignon, and Pope Francis is supposed to come to Marseille, which is 40 or 50 miles outside of Avignon, which I frequented too. So what is the reason behind that?
Okay, so back during the Middle Ages, the Pope, even though he was the Bishop of Rome, for a time resided in the French city of Avignon. And this is a period known as the Avignon Papacy. And it is generally regarded as a bad period because the Pope's the Bishop of Rome and he's not even in Rome. And so that may have given rise to local legends in France. I'm not familiar with them, but it may have given rise to legends in France that no Pope should ever go to Avignon again. But that's not literally true. Popes are perfectly free to visit Avignon or Marseille or any other place in France, but they just shouldn't take up permanent residence there. They should be in the main in Rome, being the Bishop of Rome, and that doesn't stop them from traveling elsewhere, but they should still be based in Rome.
Thanks very much for getting the question out anyways. Jimmy, thank you very much. Congratulations on the big move back to Arkansas.
Thank you. My pleasure. And I know you're moving over to the Alpha Quadrant next, so have a good time there.
We will be going to the Alpha Quadrant. I think I'm going to the Alpha Quadrant twice a day because there's a new episode of Strange New Worlds tonight.
Yeah.
Two visits to the Alpha Quadrant. All right, coming up, Mark Brumley will continue with Open Forum. If you're on the line, stay on the line. Mark will be here in just a couple minutes. If you haven't called yet, there's two lines open, 888-318-7884.